everyone to the Conference Committee on House File 5242, which is the Conference Committee on Transportation, Labor, and Housing. Today is Monday, May 13th, 2024. The time is 10:32. We are in the Capitol in room G3. So I hope everyone had a wonderful weekend, beautiful sunshine, celebrating your mothers or being celebrated as mothers. We got to hang out with each other a lot this weekend, which is always a lot of fun. A quorum is present. Members and to the public, we are going to be primarily focused in this morning meeting of the conference committee on taking testimony. We have a number of folks who have signed up on the list, and so we'll be taking those in order if you have that. A couple of folks are jumping off the list, so it'll go a little faster than we had thought it would. And we'll wait until Senator McEwen is here to confirm, but I believe that Labor is in a position, the Labor Conference Committee. We have Senator Nelson here. Representative Nelson, excuse me. Don't mean to demote you. Senator McEwen. So I believe you will be ready with a package of proposals for consideration and adoption. So we'll do that right after we have testimony. Transportation won't be quite ready for a few reasons, but we're getting close on some stuff, but we want to have more conversation with the GOP as well as, as others, and you know, just do everything in good order and of course make sure things are posted ahead of time. So we're not quite ready to move some positions for transportation. I think housing is getting close. But we'll hear a report from the housing chairs in a little bit to figure out where they are on everything. So I should also say that joining us remotely is Senator Morrison, and she's joining us from Deep Haven. So, Mr. Chair. All right. Mr. Chair, see if you have any opening comments.
No, just thanks everybody for being here, and we wanted to get some public testimony in today, and then we'll start with some motions on adopting various provisions, particularly in labor.
Wonderful, great. All right, so with no further ado, we will kick things off, and we are graced by, honored by the presence of Commissioner Ho, Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing, and with the exception of Commissioner Ho, because she's, you know, from officialdom, we're hoping folks can confine their testimony to around 3 minutes or so. Great. So, Commissioner Ho, well, she might be out in the hallway conferring. So we'll let her finish up her conversation in the hall, and we'll go to Ben Helvick Anderson from Beacon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Dibble and members of this committee. My name is Ben Helvick Anderson, and I am the Vice President of Policy and Organizing.
Attention, attention. There has been an emergency reported in the building. Proceed immediately in an orderly manner to the nearest exit and leave the building.
Okay, we'll be in recess.
Attention.
flying colors. Excellent job on the fire drill. Thanks. All right. So should we revert? I thought I saw Commissioner Ho come into the room. No. Is that true? All right. I did see her. All right. I guess we'll go to Mr. Helvick Anderson then again. So I did see her. She's spinning a lot of plates right now. So, all right. So taking from the top, Mr. Helvick Anderson, welcome.
All right. I'll try not to set off an alarm this time. So thank you, Chair Dibble and members of this committee. My name is Ben Helvick Anderson. I'm the Vice President of Policy and Organizing at Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative, and I'm here to speak on to the housing provisions of the bills. Beacon is among the Minnesota's most prolific developers of permanent, supportive, deeply affordable housing with on-site services to meet the unique needs of our residents. We are grateful for all of your excellent work on these bills, especially the chairs of the Housing Committee, and your understanding that Minnesota nonprofit affordable housing ecosystem is extraordinary, but it is also fragile. Without this dynamic public-private partnership, few of our collective housing goals are possible. We have to work to protect it, and these bills are a step forward. The mental health crisis, opioid epidemic, and aftershocks of the pandemic economy have hit our residents hard. For Beacon, this means operational challenges, surging costs, declining revenues, stacked on already razor-thin margins, and old assumptions about the actual cost of serving residents, especially in supportive housing, no longer work. Without your responses represented in this bill, we would lose affordable housing, which would be devastating to our shared goals of meeting the housing moment and hurt the lowest income Minnesotans. We really appreciate these four parts of your bills that move us forward. First, in both the House and the Senate versions, funding $50 million of the Housing Affordability Preservation Investment Program, which will help distressed affordable housing buildings create stability for residents, found in both bills. Secondly, in the House bill, changes to the Housing Infrastructure Bond statute that provides more flexibility in the eligible use around supportive housing. Third, in addition, in the House bill, the addition of supportive services, rental assistance, and operations as eligible uses of the Metro local government assistance from the money generated from the metro area sales tax. And last, the creation of a housing task force for long-term stability of affordable housing to really look at long-term solutions to ensure the stability of affordable homes for residents in the future. We think these provisions move us forward in a strong way and are very much grateful for the collaboration of the Housing Committee, especially our housing chairs, working with advocates to understand the moment and move our state forward. Thank you.
So everyone noticed 5 seconds to spare. That was perfect. Oh, except we do grant more leeway for the commissioner. Please come forward. Welcome, Commissioner. Welcome, Commissioner.
Chair Dibble and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to provide brief remarks today. I'm Jennifer Ho, Commissioner of Minnesota Housing. Let me begin by thanking my chairs, Chair Howard and Chair Port. I am grateful that throughout session, you have been committed to ongoing dialogue despite differences in perspectives. We've had both good and hard conversations, and I believe we're close to an agreement that would balance a variety of pressing housing needs, including, and perhaps most importantly this session, preservation needs. We get a fire alarm and now the lights go out. This is I'd like to speak to the proposed reallocation of $40 million of last year's housing infrastructure appropriation to create a new preservation program. I understand the goal to provide more resources to support the preservation and recapitalization of nonprofit housing partners, particularly in the metro area. I have always shared this goal and I always will. The agency partners every day with housing developers to improve the viability of projects facing financial difficulties. It's what we do. Together, we work on a case-by-case basis to explore solutions. It's a dire situation for some housing partners. especially in the metro area, with financial challenges in both revenue and costs, staffing challenges, high interest rates, and escalating insurance premiums. I wish our target were higher, but it's not. Reallocating housing infrastructure resources out of the agency's annual selections process will make balancing preservation needs harder. We already risk losing federal rental assistance that supports our most vulnerable Minnesotans because of a lack of resources. Once federal rental assistance is lost, it's gone forever. The federal rental assistance program is not growing. We do not get those rental assistance dollars back. Last year, when we had more resources available than we could ever have imagined, the agency still had to say no to 3 out of 4 projects that came through the door because we did not have enough. If we move housing infrastructure dollars out of the regular selections process, we could be saying no to 7 out of 8. This at a time when preservation needs are great, but so too is the need for more housing. Sponsors of over 100 projects have recently submitted intent to apply letters for our upcoming annual selections. Many of these are anticipating using housing infrastructure resources. The shift of housing infrastructure resources will mean the agency would say no to an even higher percentage of projects. This will result in even fewer projects to preserve developments that have critical federal rental assistance, even fewer Greater Minnesota workforce housing developments, even fewer permanent supportive housing projects for people who are sleeping outside, even fewer projects that support our tribal nations, and even fewer developments proposed by developers of color. I want to reiterate how pleased we are about several provisions agreed to so far, like additional funding for the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program and the governor's policy recommendations that helps us respond to changing needs and do our work even better. Thank you for this. It's important that we reach agreement to move this bill forward. In addition to the resources, rent assistance voucher holders across the state of Minnesota, whether through the traditional HUD Housing Choice Voucher Program or the new Bring It Home Rental Assistance Program, face discrimination in their attempts to rent an affordable home for their families, and this bill includes provisions to protect them from discrimination. I look forward to working through our differences so that we can address the many competing housing needs that Minnesotans face across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. So I'll call the next 3 folks on the list. We have Ann Mavity from the Housing Partnership, Margaret Kaplan from Housing Justice Center, and Peter Coyle from Housing First. Welcome, Ms. Mavity.
Thank you. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Ann Mavity, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership. We work across the state and actually across the nation, but we provide research such as the State of the State's Housing Report. We use that to drive policy solutions, like we're doing today, as well as providing direct technical assistance to rural communities and tribal nations as well. There's many excellent provisions in this bill, and I want to take a moment to uplift a few of our priorities. The Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program is absolutely critical to families in jeopardy of experiencing homelessness. FHPAP provides critical emergency rental, utility, and other important assistance. And with half of all renters in Minnesota paying more than they can afford for rent, investments in FHPAP have never been more important. So we thank Chairs Howard and Port for including substantial funding amounts for FHPAP. As valuable as rental assistance is, it's only life-changing when families can actually use it. The bill before you merely amends existing statute to clarify the legislature's original intent to protect families from source of income discrimination. Source of income discrimination, or SOI, occurs when a landlord refuses to rent to a housing applicant because of that person's form of income. Housing assistance can include a variety of programs, including state programs like Bridges and FHPAP, federal programs like VASH vouchers and housing choice vouchers. Housing assistance is a scarce resource. Right now, it's only available to 1 out of 4 families that need it. They may be on waiting lists for years and years. But if landlords then discriminate against people with housing assistance, these under-resourced families are denied the opportunity to use it to find stable, supportive, and affordable housing. And research suggests across the country that cities and states with these protections face dramatically lower rates of discrimination. So it's an essential tool to prevent homelessness, deconcentrate poverty, and expand choice. So we ask you to support the House's position on SOI. The third issue I want to highlight is the importance of the state's nonprofit housing providers and supporting them at this time of unprecedented financial pressure. The House position redirects existing resources to provide resources for recapitalization and to support operations. These resources will prevent the displacement of some of the state's most vulnerable residents, because the impact of not acting is that providers can lose existing housing that is used by our lowest income families. And residents have a hard time in finding that because new housing takes years to build. We need to preserve and recapitalize what we have. The impact on our lowest income tenants is at stake. The last note I'll mention is just about the Senate position that we support that limits local mandates on residential aesthetics. And I'll leave it. Is that my time? Yeah. Great. Thank you so much for your work on this.
Thank you, Ms. Mavity. So we have Margaret Kaplan, Peter Coyle, and Kelly Law. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Kaplan, and I'm the president of the Housing Justice Center. And I'm here today to testify in support of the House's position in Section 1 discrimination based on housing assistance. I've spent the last two decades working on issues related to safe, stable, dignified, and affordable housing free from discriminatory barriers. And I can say with great confidence that the prohibition on source of income discrimination, the ability to do something about that here today, is one of the most consequential issues related to discrimination, segregation, and access to opportunity in our housing system. We serve clients all the time, and we talk to them about their struggles in the housing system. Veterans in St. Cloud, families escaping domestic violence in Duluth, a personal care aide looking for a place to live in Bemidji, or a person with disabilities in Orono. These are all people who've been denied housing because they use a form of housing vouchers. This wouldn't happen if they lived in Florida, Utah, Illinois, North Dakota, or 15 other states across our country. And the Minnesota legislature believed that this was important back when they passed the Minnesota Human Rights Act, initially preventing source of income discrimination. This was the law of the land here until the court incorrectly decided the Edwards case. As it stands, though, not only do we leave families with unstable housing, we leave critical resources on the table as people who need housing assistance try in vain for months to use their voucher, whether it's a VASH voucher, Section 8, Bridges, and soon the Bring It Home rental assistance. The shopping success rate, the rate at which people who receive vouchers are able to use that voucher to find a place to call home, varies across the state of Minnesota, but in many jurisdictions, it hovers around 50%. So half the people who get that golden ticket never get the opportunity to use it, and they have to turn it back. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, the White House Blueprint, the American Bar Association all agree that people should not be denied housing just because their rent is paid with a voucher. The research is clear that protection from source of income discrimination expands opportunity for families, creates equitable opportunities for fair housing choice, and is one of the most consequential things that we can do to ensure that people have safe, stable, affordable places to live, free from discriminatory barriers in the community of their choice. Now is our time to fix it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we have Peter Coyle, Kelly Law, and John Beauchet from the Associated Builders and Contractors. Welcome, Mr. Coyle.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lawyer lobbyist with Larkin Hoffman, and I represent Housing First Minnesota. Thanks for the opportunity to speak briefly with you this morning. We all know from our general awareness of the marketplace that housing shortages in Minnesota are acute and growing. It's not just a matter of cost, it's also a matter of supply. The legislature had an ambitious policy agenda this session, which we appreciate, that was intending to address both supply and affordability. And unfortunately, that faltered. Notwithstanding that, there is a provision in the Senate bill that addresses housing aesthetics and attempts to limit those provisions as it relates to local government approvals. And we appreciate that language being in the bill, and we hope the conference will adopt it. By itself, it could affect the cost of housing by tens of thousands of dollars. And it's a meaningful reform that we encourage you to consider. Unfortunately, the conference is also confronting major changes to labor classification statutes in Minnesota, which will take us in the opposite direction by making housing more affordable and housing supply less available. And it will do that by making it harder to operate as an independent contractor in Minnesota. We have an acute shortage of subcontractor suppliers in this marketplace. And unfortunately, the language that's before the conference would add a regulatory burden and regulatory cost to the marketplace, making it harder for people to be successful in that space without tripping over unnecessary regulatory burdens that the state will have imposed. And we would urge the conference to reconsider adoption of that portion of the bill. Then finally, Mr. Chairman, I want to address the a provision in the House side dealing with the energy code. Minnesota already produces the most energy efficient homes in the country. And we think that the addition of the energy code provisions that are in the House side will add regulatory costs and burdens that are not necessary, that the consumer doesn't need, and frankly won't advance the goal of energy efficiency in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify briefly today. I appreciate that. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. So Kelly Law from the MCCD is next. Josh Beauchesne after her, and then Cecil Smith from Minnesota Multi-Housing. Welcome.
Chair Dibble, members of the conference committee, my name is Kelly Law, and I'm a senior policy and field building advisor with the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers. I want to voice my support for the Senate and House position on their proposal to help direct more resources to preserve deeply affordable rental homes in Minnesota through the Housing Affordability Investment Program. MCCD's affordable housing members are struggling to keep up with the mounting expenses that they have no control over, from supportive services gaps, labor shortages, skyrocketing insurance premiums, increased security demands, depleted reserves, rental arrears, to major physical improvements that need to be addressed to ensure the safety and well-being of their residents. Last summer, one of our members, Hope Community, made the difficult decision to close one of their supportive housing buildings, the Dundry. This closure ultimately resulted in 25 households being displaced. Some of these residents, who had been stably housed for 20 plus years, had to return to a shelter. Facing labor shortages, financial shortfalls to make repairs, security concerns, and insurance increases, Hope decided that they could no longer safely keep the building open. It is now vacant, boarded, and has had two substantial fires and needs to be demolished. Hope asked every government partner for help, and no one believed that their situation was actually as dire as it was. To our government partners listening, please let the Dundry serve as an example. We cannot afford to lose any more deeply affordable housing. I want to thank Chair Port and Chair Howard for being incredible champions in this work. We appreciate that you take the time to listen and truly see advocates as partners in solving Minnesota's housing crisis. I also want to thank all of MCCD's members for their commitment to this work and their dedication to the nearly 30,000 Minnesotans that call their properties home. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Law. So John Beauchesne, Cecil Smith, and then Steve Swerbel from Wireless Internet Service Providers. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Dibble, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Beauchesne. I'm here on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some brief comment. ABC is a trade association made up of 240 commercial and industrial contractors and their 20,000 plus employees. These men and women are part of the 75% of workers in the construction industry that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. I'm going to focus my comments on two specific topics that are included in the labor portion of House File 5242. First, we remain opposed to the provisions in Article 10 of the House bill that make changes to the laws regarding independent contractor classification. We are concerned that these changes are overly punitive with no showing of knowledge or intent required for the numerous violations and penalties that are included within the bill. With no showing of intent required, we are concerned that honest contractors who make good faith mistakes will be found to have violated the law and will be liable for tens of thousands of dollars in penalties. We are also concerned with the expanded scope of the Commissioner of Labor's authority, including the authority to issue stop work orders at one or more job sites based on a single violation. In the construction industry, a single isolated violation at one job site could subject a contractor to the closure of all of its job sites, which would have a broad negative consequence. We urge the committee to not adopt these provisions. Second, while we are fundamentally opposed to the expansion of prevailing wage mandates, we prefer the Senate language, which limits these mandates to projects that receive low-income housing tax credits. We are concerned with the cost implications of expanding prevailing wage to projects that receive TIF assistance and projects that receive certain sales tax exemptions, and the impact that these mandates will have on development across the state. Rather than enacting policies that increase costs and make it more difficult for high-quality developers and contractors to compete, we believe that the state should be encouraging policies that promote fair and open competition in the construction industry and obtain the best value for taxpayers. As such, we urge the committee to not adopt the additional prevailing wage mandates that are included in the House version of the bill. In conclusion, we are hopeful that the conference committee will take our thoughts into consideration as decisions are made. We thank you for the opportunity to provide comment.
Thank you, Mr. Beshe. We have Cecil Smith, Steve Swerbel, and then Brent Christensen from the Telecom Alliance. Welcome, Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cecil Smith. I am President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. MHA represents 2,200 members who own and operate 300,000 rental units, serving over 600,000 Minnesotans. I'm here today to provide our opposition on two provisions in the Supplemental Transportation, Housing, and Labor Omnibus Bill. Article 13, Section 22 of the House language is a rent control policy applied to senior LIHTC housing. As members of MHA have pointed out in prior public testimony, implementation of this policy would be disastrous for the long-term sustainability of senior LIHTC housing providers. While this proposal is narrowly focused on a specific program, it will lead to broader avoidance and disinvestment in this housing product, which is the opposite of what is needed to address our state's housing shortage. If the goal is to create and preserve housing affordability for low and middle income seniors, the state should look at other options such as supplemental assistance. Given the demographics of our state, Minnesota needs substantially more senior affordable housing in the coming years. This provision undermines that effort. Article 14, Section 1 of the House language requires participation in the federal government's Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program. Section 8 is a voluntary federal program that allows housing providers to choose whether or not to participate in the program. As the state of Minnesota continues to invest in housing, more rental housing opportunities become available to voucher holders. Since 2019, Minnesota Housing has invested in over 7,000 new multifamily rental units that have agreed to accept Section 8 vouchers in their development agreement. Participation in the Section 8 program is more than just receiving a rent subsidy from the government on behalf of a resident. It requires agreement to the terms of the HAP contract. Complying with the contract's requirements and having a contract supersede your lease terms, including an ability to end the lease when the housing authority fails to pay. MHA remains opposed to compelling housing providers to sign a contract with the federal government. I want to thank the conference committee for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Steve Swerbel from Wireless Internet Service Providers, and then after him will be Brent Christensen from the Telecom Alliance, and then Tracy Blasenheim from the University of Minnesota Labor Rights Coalition.
All right. Honorable members of the committee, thank you so much for taking the time to hear me today. WISPA is the trade association for broadband without boundaries. We are deeply opposed to the onerous new licensing requirements that would be created in the broadband provisions of the omnibus bill that you're considering today. WISPA is a national trade association representing nearly 1,000 fixed wireless providers, including 7 member companies in Minnesota. WISPA members provide reliable and robust fixed wireless and fiber broadband access across Minnesota and the United States. The broadband workforce outlook in Minnesota is already deeply troubling. In March, a report by the Telecommunications Industry Association suggested that the nationwide industry faces a current shortfall of 200,000 workers. A study by the nonpartisan Benton Institute in October of 2023 shows that providers across the country need significantly more workers than they currently have to meet their network expansion goals. According to the Benton Institute report, half of the providers think that they will add between 5 and 20 new positions to their workforce, and 60% of those technician positions that will be doing the work that we are talking about here today are already expected to be somewhat difficult or very difficult to hire. The addition of new licensing requirements would force projects to a halt as workers get certified and create major new hurdles to hiring plans. The effect is simple. Broadband providers will refuse to participate in the BEAD program that will transform Minnesota. A clear example comes from a WISPA member who is currently considering applying for BEAD grants, but these changes that you're considering today would make it impossible for him to consider, and it was unlikely that he would be able to participate. We urge you today to ensure that Minnesota's broadband plans are not hampered by these onerous new restrictions, and WISPA welcomes any opportunity to talk with you further about how our members provide broadband and what we will need to continue to support Minnesota's broadband efforts and ensure that we truly and permanently close the digital divide over the next coming years. Thank you again for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. So, Brent Christensen, then Tracy Blasenheim, and then Melissa Wolf from the Cable Association.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, or MTA. The MTA membership is a mix of cooperatives, family-owned, privately held, and publicly traded broadband providers throughout Minnesota. While MTA members have many different corporate structures, one thing we have in common is our commitment to serving Minnesota. This year, my members are planning on investing nearly $300 million in private capital to expand broadband in Minnesota. I am here today to oppose the broadband labor language in Article 9 of the House language and Article 8, Section 2 of the Senate language. My members oppose this bill for a variety of technical and policy reasons, but most importantly, because the House language does not comply with the Notice of Funding Opportunity issued by the National Telecommunications and Information Agency, or NTIA, for the Broadband Equity, Access, and Deployment Program, or BEAD. It also does not conform with Volume 2 plan filed by the Office of Broadband Development last December. The House language puts at risk the loss of $652 million in federal BEAD dollars earmarked for Minnesota and anywhere from $163 million to $652 million in matching private investment in two ways. First, it does not comply with the BEAD program rules and obligations. And second, I've heard from my members that they have no intention of applying for BEAD dollars under these conditions. The reporting obligations and regulatory burdens are too onerous and not worth their matching private investment. So what happens if the broadband providers walk away from this and don't participate? Well, I can tell you it won't get built. And if it doesn't get built, the state of Minnesota will default on its obligations to NTIA. Our issue with the Senate language is the fact that it requires all workers involved in underground installation of broadband facilities to be certified in directional boring, whether they do that job or not. That means backhoe operators, direct plow bury operators, and other equipment and non-equipment operators have to be certified in directional boring and not the job they're trained to do. If this is truly about safety, then let's do it right. Let's put together a task force to determine what jobs need to be certified and which do not, and what skills need to be trained on, and how much time is actually required for effective training. As Chairman and members, please do not adopt this language and give the party a chance to do it right. And with that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. So I'll call forward Tracy Blasenheim, and then after Tracy is Melissa Wolf, and then Patrick Hines. Welcome.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm a political science lecturer at the University of Minnesota.
Please introduce yourself just for the tape. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Tracy Blasenheim of the University of Minnesota and the UMN Labor Rights Coalition. As I said, I teach political science at the U, and I'm here today because state law effectively prevents me and thousands of my colleagues from having a union. If the committee members would find the item bargaining unit 11 in your packets, you'll be able to see the problem for yourselves. It's pretty stark. This is the only union, what you see in front of you is the only union that the law would currently allow me to form. Unfortunately, it's virtually impossible to organize. To win this union, my fellow lecturers and I would have to convince all of the various groups on this sheet to bargain collectively with us. And as you can see, that list includes thousands of HR staff, IT professionals, student service providers, athletic trainers, and so on. Now, mind you, this unit spans the entire state, not just the Twin Cities campus where I work. But you won't find faculty instructors on this list. The law divides educators at the U into three separate units and bars us from unionizing together. I do apologize for the small font size on this sheet. It was the only way to fit it on a single piece of paper. And that's kind of the point. In other words, basically to form a union, the law tells me that I should organize the director of athletics. He makes $1.4 million a year. And he is on that sheet. But I can't unionize with an assistant professor or an adjunct who teaches the same classes in the same rooms for the same department. In sum, this is the labor version of gerrymandering. The law bars us from unionizing with our actual coworkers while lumping us together with far-flung employees who perform entirely different jobs. And other UMN workers have it even worse. Over 10,000 are barred from unionizing simply because they receive financial aid, participate in work study programs, work part-time, or are paid through stipends and waivers. Nobody should lose their collective bargaining rights simply because they win a fellowship or because their parents didn't make enough money last year. The Senate's version of this omnibus offers a common sense solution to this mess. It simply removes these extraordinary rules and barriers. These changes would not grant us a union. They wouldn't give us any special treatment. They simply would allow us to play by the same rules as K-12 educators, bus drivers, municipal clerks, and other public sector workers in the state. All told, this affects over 23,000 workers from the U. On their behalf, I urge you to adopt the Senate's language and put an end to this rigged system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Blasenheim. So next up is Melissa Wolf, then Patrick Hines, and then after Patrick Hines will be John Thorson from LIUNA. Mr. Ornstein took his name off the list for those who are following along. Welcome, Ms. Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Melissa Wolf, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Minnesota Cable members have been looking forward, along with their industry partners, to finishing the job of achieving universal broadband service to all Minnesotans by 2026. Minnesota is in the home stretch in the race to achieve these goals with the help of $652 million in federal grant funding from the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, or BEAD, program, matched by an equal amount of private sector investment. All totaled, the BEAD program holds the promise of $1.3 billion in broadband investment in the next 4 years. Unfortunately, with the finish line in sight and other states behind us, provisions contained in Article 9 of the side-by-side threaten to stop Minnesota's pursuit of universal broadband service in its tracks. The House language in Article 9 would repeal the prevailing wage exemption for Minnesota's border-to-border program and effectively require all BEAD projects to pay prevailing wages. Recognizing the need to stretch BEAD funding, Congress intentionally did not apply the Davis-Bacon Act to BEAD. Minnesota is going to need every penny of the $1.3 billion, and maybe then some, to reach the remaining unserved Minnesotans. The prevailing wage requirements in Article 9 will guarantee that a substantial number of Minnesotans remain without access to high-speed broadband indefinitely. The House language also contains completely unworkable new requirements that would apply wholly irrelevant federal regulations designed for liquefied natural gas pipelines and drug and alcohol testing programs designed for the airline industry and other US DOT regulated industries. The only language that is the same between the House and Senate version starts at R39 and continues to R41. This language creates an unjustified, burdensome new broadband installer certification program. The labor union backing the legislation has accused the broadband industry of unsafe underground construction practices based on a report that admits that the data it relied on is plagued by many unknowns. yet the author did not hesitate to make deeply flawed, sensationalized findings. We are not claiming we have a spotless safety record. All we ask for is fact-based legislation. To further demonstrate how off the mark these broadband safety provisions are, they don't even assign the responsibility to the right state agency. Historically, underground construction safety has always been the responsibility of the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety, not DLI. In testimony on this bill this session, DLI stated it lacks the expertise to develop broadband industry safety standards and did not want the responsibility for doing so. They requested that these standards be developed by somebody else. Appointment of a task force would ensure that new safety standards are developed by stakeholders who are competent and willing to do the work. At the very least, if the legislature feels it must pass something this session, the training and certification requirement in the Senate language should be limited to directional boring and locating of facilities, rather than broadly requiring every broadband worker to become certified. A one-size-fits-all approach for safety training will not work. In addition, because DLI has stated that they do not have the expertise to develop the standards, someone must develop the standards for DLI to approve. A task force is the responsible way for these standards to be developed. The task force should be given the time to do its work, make recommendations to DLI, and the industry should be allowed time to get compliant. The effective date of the new requirements should therefore be moved from July 1, 2025 to January 1, 2026. So this is not being implemented in the middle of a construction season. And we have proposed an amendment that accomplishes this, and I know I'm at time, so I will wrap up there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. I'll call forward Patrick Hines. After Patrick Hines is John Thorson from LIUNA, and then Sherry Munyon from the Minnesota Public Transit Association. Welcome, Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member. For the record, my name is Patrick Hines with Messerly Kramer, representing the Community Associations Institute Minnesota Chapter. CAI is an international organization representing the interests of homeowner associations. I'm here to testify on language that's found in the housing policy section, specifically sections 1 and sections 24 through 27. This language was added as a Senate floor amendment and has not been heard as a bill in either body. And it contains 10 to 12 different provisions that are all very complicated. And we would strongly recommend that the conference committee not adopt this without having significant discussion. Just as an example, last year the legislature passed significant changes to the Common Interest Ownership Act. It's in Laws 2023, Chapter 57. That language was brought by Legal Aid, and they spent the better part of a year working with numerous stakeholders and legislators to refine the language in a way to protect the interests of their clients while also protecting the interests of residents and homeowner associations. And we feel strongly that this type of legislation needs significant work. A few examples. On page R30, they set a maximum cap of $100 for a single violation. One of the most typical fines that associations have to deal with are for smoking violations. You will usually see escalating fines starting maybe at $50 or $100 and increasing if people don't get the message and continue to smoke. This language would prohibit an association from doing that, and I think for the non-smokers in the association, they'd be very unhappy if a board was restrained in trying to enforce non-smoking ordinances. Another example is short-term rentals, which has become an increasing problem for associations, especially with absentee owners. If the Packers are in town for a game, you could rent out a unit for $2,000 for the long weekend, and the maximum fine you would have to pay is $100, even if it was a flagrant violation of the rules. That's a pretty insignificant cost of doing business if you choose to do that and would really hamstring a board's ability to enforce the rules. On page R33, the language would say that assessments, certain fines and related charges are not liens. This directly contradicts language that was passed last year as part of the legal aid bill. The reason fines and other charges need to be liens is not to make it easier to foreclose on residents, but to protect residents in the association in the instances when a bank forecloses for non-payment. When you go through the foreclosure process, all the liens will be paid from the sale, including that money owed to an association. If it's not a lien, they're not going to collect at the sale. and that's going to leave a hole in the budget. The only way to fill it is by spreading out the costs amongst all the other residents in the association. So we think that's a significant unintended consequence. Finally, there's an anti-retaliation provision. Again, on its face, we think retaliation is bad, and that should be pretty easy, but that's why we have a Judiciary Committee to work these things out. The language in the bill would prohibit an association from making a waiver of a fine contingent on dismissal of a lawsuit. That's a mediated settlement, and it would really not work out very well if there was a lawsuit that was being mediated and you couldn't settle it that way. So again, I'm at time. I appreciate your consideration, and again, we hope that this type of language can be worked on in the interim or perhaps next session. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. So I'll call John Thorson forward. After John Thorson is Sherry Munyon, and then Joel Mueller from the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. Welcome, Mr. Thorson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Thorson. I'm legislative director for LIUNA, Minnesota, and North Dakota, a union of 14,000 men and women who build and maintain our state's critical infrastructure. I'm here today to speak in support of a number of provisions in House File 5242 before you, as amended. In particular, the inclusion of prevailing wage through a number of funding sources will ensure that capital projects funded through either low-income housing tax credits, local sales tax, are covered by prevailing wage in a way that's consistent with similar projects supported by state bonding or receiving tax credits for economic development purposes. Doing so levels the playing field for high road contractors by increasing transparency through certified payroll reporting and provides state and local governments the most effective tool for preventing the intentional misclassification of construction workers. The broadband provisions establish guardrails to ensure that broadband is not being employed at the expense of worker safety, public safety, or in ways that compromise critical electric, gas, water, and telecommunications infrastructure. It does so by establishing a basic safety training standard for the installation of broadband, similar to what exists today for pipe laying in Minnesota, and it also holds bad actors accountable for damage to critical underground utility infrastructure when broadband is being installed. This provision raises quality and safety standards. It enhances worker training, seeks to reduce workforce turnover, and helps to ensure that public investments in broadband will deliver middle-class jobs in every corner of the state. The concerns expressed about the provisions that remain in the bill jeopardizing BEAD funding may have been appropriate for an earlier version of the bill, but the bill's provisions that are before you, either in the House or Senate side, do not do that. As instructed, we've continued to have productive engagement with important stakeholders, including the Rural Electric Association, Telecom and Cable Associations, DLI, Office of Broadband, and the Commissioner of Deed, as we work toward raising transparency, training, safety standards of broadband deployment throughout the state. I also want to speak to the provision dealing with misclassification of workers, a widespread and pervasive practice in the construction industry today. The intentional misclassification of workers is so prevalent in construction because the financial incentives are too great and the tools that exist for enforcement are not adequate. We appreciate your strong consideration of these provisions, and want to thank Chair Dibble for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much, Mr. Thorson. All right, so we have Sherry Munyon up next from the Public Transit Association, Joel Mueller from the Locomotive Engineers, and then Abby Breidach from the Asphalt Pavement Association. Welcome, Ms. Munyon.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Sherry Munyon representing the Minnesota Public Transit Association. MPTA supports the proposed discussion included in the Senate provision on dynamic transportation, together with policies and funding to increase efficient service in greater Minnesota with multiple mobility options. We strongly urge the proposal in the bill be broadly inclusive to ensure that all aspects of planning and providing transit are included, as well as the input of users. A review of existing efforts should be included to give the legislature a full picture of service and gaps. Current efforts include the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access, MNCOTA, who works towards enhancing transportation coordination, accessibility, and efficiency across the state in collaboration with other state agencies and RTCCs. There are 13 separate agencies and organizations, including the Department of Transportation, Deed, Commerce, Board on Aging, Council on Disabilities, and Human Services. RTCCs are the Regional Transportation Coordinating Councils. Working with MNCOTA, when RTCCs are fully implemented, it is anticipated that there will be significant improvements to access. They are working to create comprehensive transportation gaps analysis within their communities with the goal of implementing services with new transportation funding partners to fill the gaps as needs change and to be flexible with the changing environment and population. Also, to implement a shared database system to address most agencies, state and local, clients' transportation access needs, and thirdly, create a streamlined cost and billing system that is user-friendly, effective, and efficient. However, the efforts of RTCCs and MNCOTA are hampered as they are not adequately funding to achieve their goals in a timely manner. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Munyon. Joel Mueller up next, then Abby Bryduck, and then Tom Gump from Rotary. Welcome.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joel Mueller with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. We're a labor union that represents the train crews that operate freight and passenger trains in the in Minnesota. On behalf of the railroad workers that we represent, we ask the committee to include the railroad safety provisions included in the House language of the transportation portion of this bill. These items include regulation on wayside defect detectors, maximum train length, yardmaster's hours of service, and additional protections for railroad workers. In efforts to appease Wall Street hedge funds, the rail carriers have reduced maintenance on track and equipment by cutting employment in the crafts that repair the railroad's infrastructure. This has put Minnesota's communities at risk. When we brought these issues to the legislature, we did so with the intention of improving safety and service, while hoping to collaborate with the rail carriers to accomplish that goal. Unfortunately, that was not the case. Over the last few months, the rail carriers have pressured Minnesota legislature by withholding fees required by state statute to ensure the safety of the industry in this state. The carriers have argued before committees that there is no data to support our position on these issues, while at the same time pressuring employees to give inaccurate information to a federal oversight body. Due to the cuts in budgets, we have watched as quality of service has deteriorated to the shippers that depend on the industry. Our members bring these concerns to this body because they are dedicated to this industry and want to see it succeed, yet remain frustrated by the inability to service customers in a dependable and timely manner. As active railroad workers with decades of experience in the industry, we are speaking with the voice and experience of thousands of railroad workers that live and work in the state. This year, we were tasked by our members to bring these issues before the Minnesota legislature because of the concerns our members have with the way the direction the industry is headed. The ideas we brought forth before this body is not unreasonable nor unrealistic and are not preempted by federal law or regulation. They are built around industry best practices and limitations on the existing railroad infrastructure. They protect workers and Minnesota communities by filling in gaps in existing state laws and regulations. When I began my career 29 years ago, derailments in industries in the industry were common. Through the dedication by the labor unions and collaboration with the rail carriers, those statistics improved. Unfortunately, with the cuts to employment and safety programs, there has been an uptick in derailments and accidents and injuries in the last few years. It's for these reasons the railroad workers are sounding the alarm. The industry is headed in the wrong direction. The language in the House version of this bill will help get the industry back on track and moving in the right direction again. Thank you.
Perfect timing. Thank you, Mr. Mueller. Abby Breidich, Tom Gump, and then Capo O'Rourke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Abby Breidich, the director of the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. I'm here to speak about two provisions in the conference in front of the conference committee today. One is the life cycle cost analysis language that we've been discussing for the last few years. And at one time, MAPA did feel like this proposal would be helpful to provide more collaboration with the department on LCCAs. But really, since then, we've had a good working relationship with the department, and at this time, we don't feel that legislation to compel this cooperation is necessary. What concerns us more, however, are the fiscal implications of the implementation of this bill might be, which would to hire one FTE in each MnDOT district and two in the metro, so a total of 9 new employees at MnDOT, and at a time where they're really struggling to already fill their positions. I think this would be a distraction. And really what we've been talking about in the last few years about leakage to the trunk highway fund. So we would appreciate reconsideration on that element. And the other item is regarding the truck weight language clarification, which clarifies that aggregate materials are considered road construction materials. We passed this language a few years ago, and since then the State Patrol has been interpreting it in a bit of a different way to not include aggregate materials that come from, say, a quarry to an asphalt plant. The language that is included almost gets at the fix, we believe. We understand that DPS and MnDOT have some language that could just tweak it to make it be ultimately effective. So we appreciate your hearing them out if they share that with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Breidich. So we have Tom Gump from Rotary International, and then Capo O'Rourke from the Small Cities.
Chair Dibble, Chair Horstein. My name for the record is Tom Gump. Just think Tom Hanks and Forrest Gump. Tom Gump. I am aide to Rotary International President 24 and 25. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify here in front of you today on behalf of all the 6,000 plus Rotarians around our state in over 160 communities. We are here to talk about the Rotary International License Plate Proposal, which is Article 2, Section 16 of House Version 5242. This is a very critical time for Rotary in Minnesota. We have just been awarded, after 10 years of trying, the Rotary International Convention, which will bring over $30 million of economic development to the state of Minnesota. Governor Walz was very much in support of this and actually came to our site visit when we were competing in the final rounds against San Francisco. Our organization is doing so many good things across our state. They're supporting food banks, they're helping with illiteracy. International, we're trying to eradicate polio. So we as Rotarians live by what we call the four-way test. It's our moral code. And what it says is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? Will it be beneficial to all concerned? And will it build goodwill and better friendships? We understand that the Senate actually has a proposal going forward that would judge license plates for nonprofits. However, there have been numerous license plates that have been approved in the past. Last year, the Lions Club was able to get theirs passed. We just ask that you consider making it fair to everyone and having it benefit everyone by including both the Senate version and the House language that would allow the authorization for the Rotary International license plates. Thank you so much for hearing us today.
Thank you so much, Mr. Gump.
Thank you.
All right, Cap O'Rourke from Small Cities.
Thank you, members. Mr. Chair, my name is Cap O'Rourke, Executive Director of Minnesota Association of Small Cities. We advocate on behalf of the over 700 cities with populations under 5,000. Our primary and most important request is related to the funding that was in both bills. As you remember, last year during the Senate Finance Committee, the final deal, we created ongoing dedicated revenue for small cities, something that we have been asking for many years, and we appreciate that. Unfortunately, due to an unforeseen call it an interpretation of revenues of coming in, it has created a one-year gap. So small cities were supposed to get $23 million in the current biennium, and due to this unforeseen gap, we are only scheduled to get $3 million. The Senate does fix the full $20 million gap. The House comes a little bit short, so we are asking that you take the Senate position on that funding and simply fulfill what you said last session that small cities would get for this biennium. Our second issue is related in the labor bill. There is an exemption for volunteer firefighters and EMS under ESST. The way that these employees operate and the way that they serve their communities, it is very difficult for our communities to apply earn sick and safe time. We've worked out some language, and we worked with DLI, and so we would ask the House to accept that. And then finally, I would just add that with regards to the broadband debate, Minnesota small cities are very concerned about the potential loss of the federal BEAD money, and that we urge that both the labor and industry side that they are able to come together, because if industry is concerned about the policies, it could have a chilling effect, which would potentially put us in a position of not receiving our federal BEAD money. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. O'Rourke. Members, I'll also call your attention to your packets with a number of letters, most of which are all stapled together. Ms. Ethier will hold up the example. So that's the packet. There's one or two agency letters embedded in there, plus DLI submitted a letter as well. So take a look through all of those, and some of those are a recitation of the testimony we've heard. So at this point, I'll ask anyone to come to the table who hadn't had a chance to sign up ahead of time, who would like to offer some thoughts to the committee. All right, seeing no one, we will close this portion of the hearing, and I'll turn to the chairs of the Labor Conference Committee report, portion of the report. I think they have some business to transact. So, Senator McEwen or Representative Nelson, who would like to kick us off here? All right, Senator McEwen, yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. We do have some provisions that we would like to adopt today. I don't know if we need our members here to go ahead and proceed with that.
Senator Port is going online.
Okay.
So she will be present if she's not already soon.
Is Senator All right. Port present?
All right. We'll give her a chance to make the transition to online if Mr. Sokup could give us the. Oh, and we'll see her. So, and then we're missing a couple. Senator Morrison is online, Senator Limmer is floating around. All right. We'll just pause for a few minutes here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. All right. Chair.
All right. All right. We're probably fine to proceed, okay. So go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I believe all of our members have seen now a sheet that's titled Labor Policy Provisions. And there it begins, it has five different items beginning on the side-by-side on R2, and then the last side-by-side on R90 to 94. So I would like to move the adoption of these provisions. As you can see, it's sort of a mix. The first item has to do with the Rise Up Center funding and language. There's a bit of language from the House and a bit of language from the Senate we'd like to adopt. There's a very small provision that has to do with privacy of combative sports data that we'd like to adopt into the final final issue, the final bill. And then the third item is a house provision on R12 to 13, dealing with the residential energy code language that we would like to adopt. And then on R43 to R73, we would like to adopt the house language in regard to misclassification, as indicated. And then that last item is the PELRA provisions that are contained in the Senate language that we heard testimony about today. And members also should have information in a packet that was provided to each member about the need for those PELRA reforms and changes to the units for U of M faculty and staff. So we'd like to adopt those five provisions.
So Senator McEwen moves the provisions as she just described. I won't repeat them. And I will now open the floor up for questions and comments. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, I'm not a member on either of these committees. However, I'm kind of feeling my way through the legislation.
We put you on because you're a quick study, Senator Lemon.
That section on R90 through R94, University of Minnesota Collective Bargaining, amending PELRA, is there an appropriation required for that particular provision? Because I kind of sense that it would require one, and yet I don't think there's a line item represented for it. So could someone explain that to me?
Senator McEwen or Representative Nelson, if you could respond to Senator Limmer's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is an appropriation in the Senate language. There is not in the House, but we'll take a look at that. So we may consider a potential allocation there, but there is some discussion about whether or not the fiscal note that we received, there's some items being contested and looked at, but that is for our consideration going forward. Thank you.
So we'll be looking at the financial package. We're adopting policy now and looking at the financial package at a later point in time.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
In the event that the Senate language in its fiscal note was not recognized in the bill, I would like to know how it would be paid for. Maybe this is not the time to get that answer, but someone might be able to tell me what are the options available to us.
Thank you. I'm not ready with an answer. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The fiscal note, from my memory, had cost to the U of M and to Minn State. I thought as part of this, we were taking Minn State out of that, if that's part of the amendment that was on there from the House language. But on the labor portion of that, there was a zero cost for the labor portion of that fiscal note. The cost was to the U of M, and again, that's what is being, the Senate is arguing that note is a little out of range. And just as a side note, when we heard this in committee, we didn't have a fiscal note. The House pulled it out because the fiscal note came after we were in Ways and Means, and it was on the floor, so we didn't have time to challenge the fiscal note. But I said in committee when we heard the bill, I hope they don't come back with a fiscal note that's outrageously high just to kill the bill. We all know about death by fiscal notes in the legislature. And I don't think there's that much cost that they're saying that they're gonna have.
Thank you. Senator McEwen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Chair Nelson also giving us that background. And I would note also that in the past, significant changes to PELRA have not had a cost. And the LBO is currently revising the fiscal note. There has just so people have a little bit of background around that. So we'll continue that conversation on funding when we discuss the labor spreadsheet, but it has been an issue for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, any further questions? We can take questions on any of the five, obviously. So questions, members. All right, so great, thank you. So Senator McEwen renews her motion to adopt the sheet as in front of you, labor policy provisions. I'm not gonna repeat it, it's in front of you, you understand it. And as a part of her motion, nonpartisan staff is authorized to make any technical changes necessary to reflect the will of the committee. And I see an affirmative nod from Senator McEwen, so. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion carries. All right. So that brings us to the end of the business that we're prepared to conduct this morning. So we'll be adjourning sooner than anticipated. Mr. Chair, thoughts? Inclination is to recess so we have the balance of the day to come back in case something comes up that we can and or should deal with. My commitment, of course, is before that we adopt any transportation provisions, we have some meaningful conversations with Senator Limmer, Senator Representative Petersburg, as well as my lead, Senator Trzynski, as well as making sure, as we've committed, we talk to the executive branch about those. So, and I don't want to get too far ahead of the public as well. I want to make sure that people know what's coming. So that may or may not be able to happen with the rest of the day. So my inclination is to recess, see if we can, get to some of those transportation provisions or not. I don't think housing is quite ready. Is that true, Representative Howard? We're not going to have any housing matters in the balance of today. Okay, great. So we won't take up any housing. Possibly some transportation items. Mr. Chair, any thoughts?
Thank you. Yes, I would concur with Chair Dibble. We definitely want to consult with both the executive branch and our GOP colleagues on a couple of items and before we reconvene. So
great.
That's a appropriate process that you've laid out, Mr. Chair.
All right, and Ms. Ethier tells me we have the room until 7 p.m., so if you just want to leave your stuff here, the room will be locked up, correct?
No.
Oh, it won't be locked, but, with some trust, you can leave your committee materials here. Don't leave your wallets and purses and phones. At that, I will recess in a moment, but if we decide we're not going to get there and bring up anything further, we'll just make a notice that the committee will be adjourned. We'll just do an electronic notification of adjournment and or that we're not coming back or something like that. But for the time being, the committee is in recess to the call of the chair.